Hello, everyone. I'm your podcast host, Brent Van Conant, bringing you another in our series of recordings focused on practical advances in soil health for Western Canadian farmers. These recordings are part of a larger soil health initiative coordinated by Assiniboine College, bringing together a network of many Western Canadian grower groups and other organizations to continue to advance soil health in ways that accommodate the unique circumstances of each farm. This podcast and the overall soil initiative are made possible through the generous support of the Weston Family Foundation. If you like what you are seeing and hearing, tell a friend and feel free to check out our website, soilhealthnetwork.ca, to find out more about our soil health project. Thanks for joining us.
Well, our guest today is Daryl Dimitrik. He's the executive director of Manitoba Pulse and Soybean Growers. I'll give you a little bit of, if you don't know Daryl, he's been around for a while in the circles that I've traveled in. But if you don't know Daryl, a little bit of his background includes the work he's done now as executive director with Pulse and Soybean Growers. But he's also been in the crop protection industry. He was a part of a farmer-led research organization for years. He's worked in Manitoba civil service, and in his civil service days, he delivered programs in resource conservation, extension, agricultural research, renewable energy and science policy, which is a mouthful. And he comes to that with a bachelor and master's degree from Manitoba and a PhD of crop science from the University of Saskatchewan. And he lives not too far from me here in Darlingford, Manitoba. Welcome, Daryl.
Thanks, Brent.
Well, you know, in addition to the packaged bio, we went to the, we called a couple of colleagues and others that you've worked with over the years, and they described you as thoughtful with big ideas and committed to collaboration. Having a deep understanding in agriculture, in breadth, in historical context, and in a long-term perspective, that you have a keen sense of when to be patient and when not to be patient about change, and that you can operate within a culture of both hardcore academia and boots-on-the-ground farm production in a way that very few are able to make that bridge as respectfully and successfully as you do. So that's not meant to you to create a high standard to live up to here on this podcast, but I'm interested in what you've got to say. I'm sure others are as well.
My, that's I'm not sure who you contacted, but
oh, all smart people, Daryl. All smart people.
Okay.
Well, obviously, the focus of this podcast is in the world of soil health and where there are practical opportunities that make sense at a farm level, where some of those obstacles might be in the way that are holding us back from some of those practical changes. You know, you have this pretty interesting perspective in the pulse world. Hard to imagine that there isn't a place for pulses in a soil health environment. Where have you and your organization kind of chosen to focus, and how's that going related to soil health?
Well, we've really, I guess our journey through soil, the thinking on soil health here in the pulse and soybean growers has taken on kind of two paths. One is we've, I think, been part of a larger multi-decade movement that's, has partially solved but continues to solve what I would call the first expression of soil health, and that's really to prevent erosion. The whole concept of how soil erosion can be destructive to farms and to entire nations goes back centuries. Probably the real turning point in Canada was the Depression, where we saw the combined impacts of sort of poor farm practice and really difficult weather conditions, drought specifically, really highlighting how fragile the soil was. And since that time, both governments and individual farmers have taken actions, first by eliminating summer fallow, and then secondly by adopting less tillage, all the way to zero tillage, to really stop soil erosion. Now that mission continues, and in pulse and soybean production, we're conscious of having to continue that, because in a large part of the Canadian prairies, soil erosion has been stopped, or significantly minimized. However, in Manitoba, we still have some work to do, and one of the things that we've recognized is that the systems to stop soil erosion through the adoption of zero tillage really were never developed for, that poorly drained eastern part of the province where there are some fairly heat loving crops grown like corn and soybeans and dry edible beans. But that is that first sort of expression of soil health. That is, if a soil is not eroding, if it's staying in place, it's healthier than a soil that's subject to erosion.
Continuing to decline soil health.
But working in pulses and soybeans, or I'll call them annual legumes, it brought about sort of a second expression of soil health, and that's kind of an unseen way. You can easily visually detect whether a soil is eroding or not, but when you look underneath, and some of the I would say less visual criteria or metrics around what is a healthy soil, things get a little more abstract. But we've also been involved in that because the legume, its claim to fame, and it owes its existence to a soil-borne biological process called nitrogen fixation. And nitrogen fixation happens well in an in a healthy soil, and not so well in an unhealthy soil. And so what that's done for us is bring forward the notion that soil health is more than just not eroding. There's a biological component to it, that you have to have healthy populations of soil microbes and various other forms of life, as well as good aeration and drainage and water holding capacity. We see that expressed in good biological nitrogen fixation. So that's our second expression, although of soil health. Although I want to really underline that it's a little more abstract, and it's complicated, and so we don't have it figured out. We're starting to, so we are investing funding into figuring out what the inclusion of annual legumes can do to that kind of more abstract, below the surface aspect of soil health.
When I suppose in the in the world of getting a legume and broader rotation, whether there's a clear measure or not, like the perfect counting earthworms or whatever you do, I think everybody gets that a pulse in the rotation can be really valuable. But there's some obstacles in the way of sometimes economic, sometimes trash management, sometimes weed management, and other things that keep the attractiveness of pulse out of somebody's rotational picture. What ways are you kind of trying to address the appeal to get pulses into more consistently grown?
Well, the driver in all of this, as usual, is economics. And so what we're looking at is trying to make the production and sale of annual legumes as profitable as possible. So attached to that, though, are a number of agronomic challenges. Some of them are dealt with through genetics. So we've invested in a lot in plant breeding, particularly in dry beans. but also in peas and working with the private sector in soybeans, because things like maturity, things like emerging in a cool soil, those kinds of things can be dealt with through genetic improvement. The other aspect of it, though, is how do pulses, what kind of synergy do you get to your overall system by including an annual legume? There are many farmers who claim that the crop after a soybean crop seems to do better.
Edible
Why
beans on
is
my farm. Almost all, are you? You want to? You always look forward to pulling the combine into the field that was edible beans last year because it seems like it's always a little bit better.
And we realized early on when soybeans started to become popular that we were a bit behind places like Saskatchewan that have been growing pulses for many decades. So we have embarked on collecting knowledge to figure out why may there be a yield bump, or if in fact there are, or is it some if it is just something that people feel, and are there observations backed up by actual measurements? So we're working on that. One of the other areas, though, that's kind of interesting, if you are a grower that has adopted, say, zero tillage, the annual legume crop, whether it's soybeans, dry beans, or peas, they'll tend to be your low residue crop. Now, somewhat paradoxically, that actually can assist soil conserving practices like zero or minimum tillage. Because if you're not cultivating the soil, you do have to contend with some fairly heavy residue crops, especially if you're growing these big crops of oats, wheat, and corn. We're not growing as much flax these days. So that was another lower residue crop. And we know that success in these reduced and no-till systems does hinge to some degree on the alternation of high and low residue crops, broadleaf and grass crops, these kinds of rotation, foundations of the rotation. Well, these annual legumes come along and they are low residue. Now, you might think low residue exposes the soil to erosion. This is true. However, in a say, five-year rotation with some of these heavier residue crops, it is good to have a lower residue crop as a break in there. So that's one thing. One of the more recent things that we've, I guess, observed is there have been some prescriptions come out for additional soil health building practices like cover crops and things like that. And they're still being developed. It's kind of a research question as to whether cover crops can be successful in this part of the world. But one thing we've noted is that if you've already got a low residue crop, let's say a dry bean crop, one might think that that land should be covered with a cover crop. However, when you think about it, a dry soil such as we had a few years ago, with a low residue crop like dry beans, even the act of seeding a cover crop creates soil disturbance. And if that cover crop doesn't immediately establish and cover, it's actually exposing the soil to more erosive forces. So it is a you can't just look at the surface of the issue. You really have to think a couple of levels below. And so the fact that most of our annual legume crops are low residue shouldn't automatically say we need to sow a cover crop in. We have to be careful.
And are you seeing some breakthroughs in methods of maybe growing edible beans that are with less disturbance, without pre-emergent incorporated chemicals and things? Are there versions of that are starting to pop up and be pretty credible?
They are popping up, and we are actively developing them, especially in our on-farm network research program that we run here at MPSG. However, I'm not sure they're ready for broad adoption yet. We do have growers across the province that have kind of created their own way of sowing dry beans without, with minimizing disturbance to the soil. But they are a crop that does like things warm in the spring, and they are a crop that work well with a pre-emergent soil applied herbicide. So there are some. There's a lot of work to do. We have done a couple of field scale studies that happen to occur in dry years, and yeah, we had better yields with say using planters with row cleaners and going directly into an undisturbed wheat stubble.
Okay.
You can understand farmers kind of wanting to look at the evidence long and hard before making any significant changes to their bean production practices. But it sure would be good if we could get to that level of confidence. And the only pathway we know to that is to continue to do research, especially at the farm level, to try and uncover some of the things that are possible.
Where are you seeing the possibilities of incorporating pulse crops into intercropping or polycrop kind of environments? I mean, I as a commercial farm, there's a piece of me that says, oh, there's a pain in the ass factor to that that I'm not sure I'm ready for, but if we could get our way through some of those difficulties, there's a logic behind that that you just can't kind of ignore. How are you approaching that, or where do you think we're at in that cycle?
Again, we have done some research, and I wouldn't say that the results are disappointing. It's more that they're so variable. And so we're interested in continuing to find ways, for say an intercrop. And the one that has demonstrated maybe a little bit more success is the pea canola intercrop. But when we've tried other, basically tried other combinations, and between work conducted in the Diversification Center network here in Manitoba, and by our agronomist in residence at the University of Manitoba, Kristen McMillan, we're seeing that some successes and some failures, and so it's that lack of predictability. I guess the other thing is that, of course, some of these pulse crops, especially things like dry beans, can be quite valuable. And anything that might hold put a lid on yield, whether it's an intercrop or something else, in other words, on purpose or by accident, is typically not well received by growers. So we still have to get over that that problem of reducing yield in the in one of the crops in order to get the benefits of an intercrop. And I think there's a significant sensitivity around that, especially in the pulse crops, just due to their value. So
Well, I guess the other thing that I maybe frightens me a little bit about that is if peas, for example, are now introduced as a great companion within a polycrop, well, how often can I come back to that field and not start to generate a disease problem because the pulse that I have, I'm playing that card a few too many times in my rotation, and now I take it through a disease problem. I take it out completely, or in theory, people talk about having less disease because it's a polycrop environment. But how do we sort our way through the kind of applied research that answers that question with the kind of confidence you or I would want to have if we were planting a quarter section?
Well, in the context of soil health, this is really for us in the annual legume business, is getting at that second expression of soil health. A lot of that stuff that happens underneath the ground, the diseases that you referred to in our crops are the most serious ones are the soil-borne or the root rot complex. Okay. So, I mean, and those things are actually an element of soil health. You can have the most conserved soil, the soil with the best aggregate stability and organic matter content and porosity and all those things. But if it's got Aphanomyces or Phytophthora, it's not a healthy soil. And so, getting back to polycropping and intercropping and things like that, it is one of those things that we are examining. Is it one of the options to hold populations of some of these soil-borne pathogens at bay? Because we really haven't got any near-term good solutions. Again, the genetic route is the preferred route and the route we're taking, but it looks like, especially in with respect to Aphanomyces eutyches, which is the really serious soil-borne pathogen for peas in Manitoba and across the prairies, there are no ready genetic solutions. It's going to be a long time before we get some resistance. So we're looking at those kinds of things. What are some of the practical steps that people can consider right now? If any crop, legume or not, has a really important role in their farm business, but also in their agronomic rotation, but you've got to deal with some of these things like diseases. One of the things that I think is a needs to be really thought about more in a sustainability context is tile drainage. We know that especially annual legumes do perform very well on tile-drained soil. That soil, in other words, is healthier. And we feel, this is something we're investigating still, but we feel it's possible that that we may be limiting the activity of some of these soil-borne pathogens because they're a pathogen type that swims. They require soil water to swim to the root and infect it. Remove some of that water, and some of these pathogens may stay at a lower level, or their
They can't
activity may
swim. They
be.
can't swim far enough.
So this is another aspect of soil health that often isn't talked about. But internal drainage is an element of soil health, and when you're dealing with a crop that likes well-oxygenated soil, like a dry bean or a pea, it's important. And if you're dealing with these crops that are susceptible to root pathogens, it's doubly important. So that's another aspect of soil health that has a really practical aspect to it. In other words, a farmer can do something about it. Now, it's expensive. Tile drainage is not something that people just throw in. However, we are seeing more tile drainage occurring across the province in grain land. And where we do see it, we're seeing improved productivity out of our legumes, out of our pulses and soybeans.
Well, and my tiling friends would say buying more land isn't cheap either. So,
True.
but invest
That's
in the
true.
land you've got, or buy more, or whatever.
Yeah.
It's part of a what needs to work, be worked through as a growth strategy. I guess we all have an understanding that soil health is a big, complicated beast. In the world you work in, who are your logical collaborators? Like, who are the other players that, boy, we can't do that, but we need to work with somebody else who gives us this other piece. And if we work together across disciplines, then maybe we can crack some of these eggs. How do you see that network, or who are your logical collaborators that you're starting to talk about that maybe you didn't even share coffee with 5 years ago, but now it's, hey, this is both of us, guys.
Right. Well, we've expanded sort of our traditional range of partners in research for one. So, groups like ours used to work with plant breeders and agronomists. And we used to work with entomologists and weeds people and pathologists and people like that. But now, soil microbiology is kind of an it discipline these days. And so, especially when we're looking at the impact of, say, root pathogens on biological nitrogen fixation in legumes, that's a job for a soil microbiologist. And so now when we're working with an agronomist, let's say, on crop rotation research, it's a requirement for that project, and as far as we're concerned, to have a soil pathogen pathologist also working on that, because we need to
Okay.
track how the soil-borne pathogens are doing across diff contrasting rotations. The other thing that we're doing is bringing in people who, previously really had nothing to do with agriculture, but they knew all about microbiology. And so they're looking at other aspects. In the soil microbial world, there's the good guys and the bad guys. And we got the pathologists looking at the bad guys, but we need people looking at the good guys and the things that are helping mobilize nutrients and the microbes that are involved in biological nitrogen fixation. That's a whole other group of scientists. But the interesting thing about that is, and this brings out in a new kind of discipline, again, as you mentioned, that's kind of complicated stuff. And so our ability to communicate that, the results of that kind of research, and turn it into practical recommendations for farmers, we're finding we have to develop that ability because it's not rocket science, but some of it gets pretty close. And so we have to be able to translate that. The other,
So,
just
go ahead.
I was going to say, one other area is that what we're finding is there's some of these new alliances form. So when you say, when we say, internal drainage and tile drainage is an important looks like it's an important aspect of soil health from a farm or a legume productivity perspective. All of a sudden, the industry, the tile drainage industry, is one of our partners, and we wouldn't have thought of that, like you say, years ago, but it is. And so are some of the conservation oriented or organized, like watershed districts and people like that. They become part of the partnership. And finally, there's a whole community and I guess a set of bureaucracies and civil society organizations wrapped around this area of climate change. And so they become partners because, the dynamics within the soil are one of the biggest things in which agriculture contributes to and provides solutions for climate change. And so they're much a bigger partner these days as well.
Well, and I join almost every other farmer that the hair starts to stand up on the back of my neck a little bit, going, wait a second, why do all these other people have some interest in the asset that I own here? The path to ensure that we're addressing some of these problems in a logical way that isn't damaging to farm enterprises is like that. There's a tricky, almost political business here that's a brand new player because of what you've just described.
We need win-wins more now than ever. The farmer needs to win, but so does some of these broader societal issues, and that's tricky. We can't shrink from it. We have to keep calm and carry on. One of the things that we kind of promote is that the annual legume crop is one of these win-wins, and it just kind of comes with the territory. Because you're not utilizing as much synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, the nitrous oxide emissions, from growing these crops is considerably lower than other crops, or other things that you can do. So, and yet farmers can make money from it, and it has all these other attached benefits. That you can go into areas of human health and support for the livestock industry, by providing local sources of protein for livestock feed and and whatnot. So there are many wins associated, and the thing about it is it's kind of a model example because no one's really trying to reduce emissions when they're planting a legume crop. They're trying to make money
Well, it's
by
not the
growing.
first on my list, I can
Yeah, it's not
assure
the
you.
first on the list, but it happens.
Yes.
And that's a good way for it to happen. Is it kind of just comes about through an economically encouraged activity that a farmer undertakes. Good for the farm and good for society. So and I think there's some really important overall soil health lessons in that really elegant example of the legume crop.
Right.
And that is, there's so many pressures that society is putting upon farmers nowadays. It seems that every couple of years there's a new layer of demand placed upon the farmer. So, produce food, produce, clean food, produce food without, produce it economically so it's cheap, produce it so that it doesn't impact the water or the wildlife. Or colorless, odorless gases going into the air, those kind of, it's a lot of weight to put on the shoulders of a small business person on a farm. But if we could really focus farmers' attention on soil health, and convince the public that that's really where the farmer should be focused. And kind of move to the side some of these other concerns, and hopefully have other elements of society, take responsibility for some of the other aspects of preserving the earth. If farmers really focused on soil, I think we would get to more win-wins, because building soil health is a win, for the farmer. But it also extends a lot of wins to broader society, whether it's through increased biodiversity. And remember, a soil microbe is part of nature's biodiversity. People can look at, the more complex organisms, the large animals, and the trees and these broader habitats. But a soil microbe has tremendous impact on nitrogen and carbon cycles that are at the base of existence on this planet. And it just so happens that farmers have the ability, to steward those things for their own benefit. But it would have extended benefits beyond, right, all the way, throughout society. So that's one thing that we're trying to champion now is let's let farmers focus on the soil. That's how they make their living. Let's do all we can to help them be good stewards. And these other things will benefit.
Daryl, you're singing from the same song sheet as what the purpose of this initiative is, to say, like, if we get soil health right, then a whole bunch of those other secondary and tertiary and other benefits evolve from it. If you don't get soil health right, then there is no sustainability cycle. We've got to get that part right. In your description of kind of the new partners that have come into the picture that you now have to relate to and work with, do we have the mechanisms and the funding streams and the university engagement and government, and like it, has that evolved at the rate that it needs to for these sort of new partnerships to address these now multidisciplinary problems like soil health? Or is that, how do we work our way through that, those changes or those obstacles?
I think in Manitoba especially, I think we need a lot of work in that area. We've had some really some good efforts on the part of a number of entities that make up, this large diverse industry called agriculture. But I think we need to really get around the table and work a little bit toward some common goals. And I think it's going to involve public sector academia, private sector initiative, certainly farmers and farm groups, the organizations that are involved in whether it's climate change or other kind of resource management and stewardship areas, be it water, watershed management, the input companies. I think with a little bit of collaborative effort from everyone, it'll add up to a large outcome. But right now, I think we're spread quite thin across many, many different areas. And again, if we were to focus on soil and soil health, I think a lot of the other outcomes will emerge as a result of that. So,
Well, you had a mouthful there when you said a collaborative effort, because anybody's experience, collaboration does require an effort, and it's almost unreasonable to expect that that effort comes all from one place, or you actually create something where the where you know there's a that sustainable effort will take place, because something emerges to do that. It doesn't happen by accident, does it?
And I think we need to be encouraged. We sort of need an issue to be brought in front of all of us that sort of crystallizes actions. I really applaud, there's been senators and different people in politics over the years that have from time to time tried to raise in the public conscience soil and how important the health of soil is. And I think that's what we need to get it to the center of the table so that everyone has sort of license and confidence, to commit to partnerships that are focused on soil health. And I think I just think that we could go a long way in this province doing that. And we'd see again improvements in other things like our water, like our emissions, like our economy, all those things, if we were really able to grab onto soil. But I do think we need that kind of collective recognition of the opportunity here. And I think we still have some work there.
And
And honestly, maybe other things that we get involved in or that we desire to do might have to wait. But I think there's some real opportunities in this space.
well, I appreciate you saying that. In a grower's world, soil health is one of maybe the top 10 priorities, and from year to year it rises to five and goes down to seven, and you're kind of back and forth. You can't do it all the time, but you want to have it in the mix. When we get to the, and you've done a pretty good job of describing sort of the environment, organizational environment that we'll need to have some of these breakthroughs. But let's take this a little bit back closer to the producer. What kind of technologies and practices or on the ground things do you think have the most potential, or need this new organizational structure to address and really wrestle with, to be able to support producers to make appreciable gains in soil health? What is your crystal balling look like to say? What are you watching the most closely in terms of technologies and practices?
And again, I'll come from really strictly the pulse and soybean perspective, but I think there's around four things that I think are achievable, and I think are key. They will really take our recognition of and our practice to achieve soil health to a new level. One thing that might be, kind of sound small, but We need tailgate technologies to detect soil-borne pathogens. And in fact, these are being developed, and MPSG has funded research that has helped enabled some of these technologies to be developed, and we'll be deploying some of these in the coming years on farms to do the evaluation. But really, we need to know what we're up against. And in pulses and soybeans, root rot is a very big thing, and that's a big part of soil health. So we need to be able to detect them, these things, as quickly and efficiently as possible.
That gun that you can point at the ground and say, "You got him, you don't got him."
Yeah,
Okay.
exactly. We need something like that. And there's, for example, a startup company in Saskatoon that has taken some genetic technology from the medical field and adapted it to identifying pathogens in soil, and that's the kind of thing that we need to do. Secondly, I'll bring back the area of tile drainage again. I think we can do a lot more in that area, both on a regulation side, on an agronomy side, and an investment side. And by the way, I think it's probably one of these areas that if we're going to maintain a thriving farming industry going out decades, we can't expect to continue farming under the projected changes in climate, the way we do now in the future. And I think things like drainage are going to be even more important as time goes on, and we face the specter of much more severe weather events. So I do think tile drainage, and on the other side, irrigation. I think irrigation is a big contributor, obviously to the economy, but also to overall soil health. So that balance between water supply and management, I think, is key.
So
Not, yeah.
I know you've got two more, but I can't let this go by, and I got to rattle your cage on this. Is that with from a conservationist kind of background, there lots of people could kind of get chills going, wait a second, if we're trying to preserve natural landscapes, running pipes and running pipes under the ground to drain and pipes over the ground to irrigate, that doesn't sound very conservationist to me. How can those principles coexist? And the people who are worried about ducks and all that kind of stuff, say, believe that we've got the win-win that you were talking about.
It's a great question, and I think it really calls upon us to come to terms with the agro ecosystem.
Okay.
We're not in a pristine ecosystem. We're in an agro ecosystem, and our job is to manage that system to do what it's there to do, but also to protect the integrity of the overall ecosystem, so that the agro ecosystem isn't a drag on the overall planetary ecosystem. So, as I mentioned earlier, a piece of farmland that's continuously waterlogged and is impacting the soil microbial community is an assault on biodiversity, although it's not recognized as such now by the broader public, because what the broader public looks at are things like trees and deer and butterflies.
Well,
And
isn't that just a swamp? There used to be swamps.
some of it would be, and if we did a better job managing some of the good farmland, it may be that some of these swamps actually are integral not just to the natural cycles, but to the farm itself.
Right.
And I think that's what wetland preservation and water storage is all about. But I do think that has to happen in concert with good agricultural soil management, which I think is looking like tile drainage is an element of that.
Well, I'm hopeful that guys like you who've wrestled with this believe that there's a path for that to happen. That's thoughtful and not just it either falls on one side of the good side or the bad side, and forever there'll be conflicts.
It's like any other technology. It's not for everywhere. It's not for everyone. But there's no question that we're being called upon in agriculture to manage water better, and we need to look at all the tools, including wetland preservation, including internal drainage, and all the other things in between. And so I hesitate to really throw out any technology because the perception is that it's not in tune with an ecological approach to farming, when it could be in tune with an agroecological approach, to farming. So,
Well, sorry for the aside here. You had
yeah, no.
two more things that you thought were key to where we go next.
Well, one of them was irrigation, but really the third one was irrigation and drainage, and its impact on salinity, because I think salinity is something, it's an element of soil health that maybe had gone out of the conversation for a while, because it was big when we used to summer fallow, and people stopped summer fallowing, and salinity, supposedly went away. But no, salinity is definitely here, and I think we're creating new routes for salts to be deposited in the root zone and on the surface of soil. So we need to pay attention to salinity and the impacts of water management on that. But the other one that, and I guess the final one, is that I still think that with some effort, we can develop true zero-till systems that work everywhere. And I think we just kind of stopped. We stopped in time, somewhere in the early 1990s, and we stopped geographically somewhere around Highway 34 in Manitoba. And I think with corn is a crop that is advancing in genetics. It's on the move here in Manitoba. It's paired with soybean elsewhere in the world, and I think it's a good pair with soybean here in Manitoba. But gosh, if we're going to encourage farmers to pull out the cultivator more often, and the disc and the tandem disc and whatnot, I think we might be selling ourselves short. So I think some synergy there is possible. I think a renewed effort to develop some of these lower disturbance tillage systems for places like the Red River Valley, the Pembina Valley, the eastern reaches of the Assiniboine, the Interlake, places like that. I think we'd do well. I think it would be a good thing to try. Not to mention the savings in time, labor, equipment, and fuel that can go with it. I think there's a really good, a strong economic argument for doing that. It might not work, but I think we need to really look at adopting zero till to some of our heavier, poorly drained, crop diverse kind of lands. And I think that'd be worthwhile.
And are you seeing or have you seen examples where the accumulation of trash from a cornfield is pretty substantial? Like the seeding the next year is no given if you haven't. I mean, guys seem to go they're deeper ripping and burying stuff deeper to get rid of all the 9 foot stalk as opposed to leaving it on the surface. What is that? Is that part shorter varieties? Is that part some way to get faster micrological breakdown? Is it strip tilling? What, how do you
I
see
think
that happening?
right now, deep burying some of these residues is the only option in many cases. So the whole challenge for us is to provide other options, and it's not likely that one option is going to fit everyone. But we know that, so I think it's handy to look at it. Do we have an agronomic problem, or do we have an engineering problem? And do we have kind of a combination of engineering and agronomics? And you asked earlier about, are things aligned, or are we've got the right partnerships? And I think this is an example where we don't. We need to get the engineers, we need to get the agronomists, we need to get the plant breeders, and we need to get all the companies involved in innovation in all those spaces, you know, to work together and look at this opportunity. It's going to be challenging. It's not easy, but on the other side, you know, we can compare what might be done with some of the potential upsides. And in the short term, we do have the potential to reduce costs for fuel, for labor, those kinds of things. And if we can do it, then I think we owe it to farmers to try and help them save that money and increase their profit margins. If it doesn't work, and if we're doing it in a scientifically valid way, it will show that it doesn't work, and we can move on. But I just don't think we've given it the proper shake, and I think we owe it to farmers to do that. So.
The mechanisms of getting things done and having and funding research and over the years, more and more of that has fallen onto the shoulders of grower organizations like yours. There's similarly the way you've talked about the weight of all of climate change can't fall on the shoulders of growers. The weight of all climate change and soil health can't entirely fall on the shoulders of grower organizations either. I guess I'm curious about how, in kind of some wrap up thoughts here, about how producers and the sort of the logical, economically viable path for producers stays within the producer's control and how that gets shaped. It is that you guys in grower organizations, is that what's the mechanisms that assures that this doesn't get away from the very folks who have the most to offer to make it really work at the farm level?
I think one of the characteristics of our industry that governments and others wrestle with is that it is a very diverse population of people. You can't say that farmers do this and farmers do that. Some farmers do this and other farmers do that, and there's a whole bunch in between. I think from a farmer's perspective, we can use that as a strength and say, look, you know, we're a collection of a whole bunch of individuals that all have their own ideals and their own backgrounds and their own skills and their own desires and their you know, their own resource bases and those kinds of things. And so if we're successful in bringing something like soil health to the center of the table, where, you know, few can deny that it is in, you know, the broader national interest to address soil health, it would certainly be in the individual farmer's interest to address soil health. But because every farmer is so different from the other, we need a tailored, much more locally driven kind of approach than we've taken to date. I think that's the way farmers can, as you say, maintain, if not control, they can maintain those that control things going in the right direction. And I'm not sure farmers need to control, but they do need to influence, and they need those that share the objective of good soil health to keep things moving in the right direction. And that's largely governments and businesses. So I think it comes back to raising in the public's conscious the importance of soil, and having decision makers realize that, and then simultaneously recognizing that, unlike other industries, where if you're seeking some big change, you can basically call a few CEOs in a room, and your auto industry or your forest industry can adapt to change.
the two
We've got
airlines or
200,000 CEOs on farms in Canada. Like each one is going to make their own decision. So as long as the people that hold the power recognize that and allow changes to be made and investigated on a local level, I think everyone's objectives can be met. That is how back in the 1980s, when it was first realized that we really need to take better care of our soil, that it was local programming where we had soil conservation clubs made up of farmers would send an experimental no-till drill around the district to try things out, you know. And in some places it worked, some places it didn't, and farmers made their decisions based on that. I think we got to do that kind of stuff again. But we need the support of broader society in order to get decision makers to realize that these things need to be funded, they need to be promoted, and they need to be local.
Well, Daryl, you're our conversation weaves us through all of the kind of both the optimism and the heavy lifting that remains. I'm encouraged that folks like you have an interest and are leaning in on a number of those topics and provide both the thoughtful historical context and kind of the forward thinking implications of what we could do and how we could do it. Producers and the rest of us are grateful that you do that kind of work, and we're grateful that we had some time with you today to discuss all that.
Well,
Certainly appreciate.
let me say, Brent, on behalf of the pulse and soybean growers, that we're really pleased that the Soil Health Network is off and running, and there's commitment from the Russ Edwards School at Assiniboine College. You know, we're behind you, and we're interested to follow the progress of the network and contribute where we can. And again, I think it's one of these partnerships and alliances that will pay off for the farmer, but for Manitobans in general as well.
Well, we both have work to do, and
We do.
it may not all be as public as this on a recorded podcast, but I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. I appreciate your time today, Daryl.
Thank you.
All right, bye for now.